Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today, it's San Francisco, the Olympic torch on its way to Beijing, and protesters out in force before it even hit the streets. China is watching, squirming, not happy. Today and all next week, we are watching China. On Point will broadcast live from Shanghai starting next Monday. We will look at many facets of Chinese life and China's rise. Today on Point, Chinese power, its sources, and its faces as China steps large into the world. Joining me this hour from Washington, D.C. is David Michael Lampton, a leading China scholar, former president of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations. He's director of Chinese studies at the Nixon Center and dean of faculty at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He's out with an important new book hot off the press titled The Three Faces of Chinese Power, Might, Money, and Minds. David Michael, Mike Lampton, Mike, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be with you, Tom.
There's so much we want to talk about with you today, but we've got to have the sound of this day and the last couple days in our ears just because it's turning everybody's heads. Listen with me, Mike, David M. Lampton, to just a little bit of the sound here out of San Francisco yesterday. This is 1,500 people, San Francisco's United Nations Plaza yesterday, in anticipation of today's torch relay, singing in Tibetan, Free Tibet Now, Free Tibet Now. This can't be happy music in Beijing, Mike.
No, it certainly isn't, and China has, in effect, set itself up for a very big problem because this was, in the Chinese mind, sort of the culmination of an attempt to increase China's soft power. And in effect, it's created a global opportunity for everybody unhappy with many aspects of Chinese policy, most notably at the moment the Tibetans, to articulate for a global audience their concerns. So China's attempt to have a coming out party is going quite sour at the moment.
And it gets worse. In San Francisco, here's Desmond Tutu, Nobel Peace Prize winner, appealing to world leaders. This is last night at a rally in the same plaza, not to go to Beijing in the Olympics.
To all leaders of the world, for goodness sake, don't go to Beijing.
That is not popular in Beijing. Here's Wang Hui from the Beijing Organizing Committee around the Olympics denouncing protests along the torch relay in Paris that happened earlier during a news conference in Beijing yesterday.
We strongly condemn the disgusting behavior of a handful of Tibetan separatists who attempted to sabotage the Olympic torch relay. The Olympic flame belongs to the people of the whole world, and it is not in favor of the public for a few people who are trying to challenge the Olympic spirit. Those acts will surely arouse the resentment of the peace-loving people and are bound to fail.
And here's an insurance company worker in Beijing, Ma Ximing, saying the torch relay has to go on for China to save face, but also to show that it can do it. It has the power.
If the torch relay does not progress smoothly, it would be a compromise from the Chinese government towards the protesters. We not only have to continue with the torch relay, but also have to tell the world loudly that we can do it.
We can do it. And there's an insurance company worker in Beijing, Mike Lampton, saying we've got to tell the world that. Wow, you're looking at Chinese power, and I can't help wondering right now if there's not quite a gap between how much of the world is looking at China and China's sense of itself, its place, its rights and agenda at this moment, Mike.
Right. I think we this is a time for a certain amount of wisdom. I think, as strange as it may sound to some people, that we have to strike a balance here between recognizing that for the Chinese people and Chinese culture, the Olympics is an affirmation of China's reemergence and dignity and coming out of a long period of national weakness and humiliation. On the other hand, the world's got to continue to push for positive change. And so how do we strike this balance to, in some sense, preserve Chinese dignity? I'm not talking about the regime's dignity. dignity, but Chinese civilizational dignity, the dignity of the Chinese people. And oddly enough, I think if this goes too far in the direction of humiliating the Chinese, you're going to find this driving much of the Chinese populace closer in identifying with its government's policies. So I think we have to strike that balance between preserving the dignity of China and the Chinese people that is bound up with this, at the same time that we articulate our disagreements and our concerns. And I think that's a very difficult thing. It's difficult for the Chinese to move off their tough position, and it's going to be very difficult for the world's NGOs and interest groups to be moderate. But I think that's what we ought to be striving for.
China may feel very publicly vulnerable to these protests right now, and it clearly is. At the same time, you write that its power has just grown and grown. It is well out now of those years of destitution and humiliation, even if the memory lingers strong. We should take the measure for us for a moment. We're going to dig in with you into the sources and faces of that power. But just as a presence on this planet right now that was sort of missing in action for a century and more, how do you size up China's clout, its standing, its power right now?
Well, what we have here is a China that for most of history since the beginning of the Common Era, China accounted, because of its vast population in considerable measure, for about a third of the global GNP. And that means China has a sense of being a very big presence in not only its region, but the world. And then in about the 1840s, it fell to about 3 or 4% of global GNP, where it stayed until 1978. And now the Chinese are moving back to reclaim their share of global GNP. They're back to about 16%. In the minds of the Chinese people, they've come a long way. That is sort of halfway back to the share of GNP they had normally had. But they're only halfway there on a very long journey. So much of the rest of the world is very impressed with the distance China's come. And they project this straight line of growth off into the indefinite future. And it becomes very large. But in the Chinese mind, I think they still see China's weakness and its vulnerabilities. And though they're becoming more confident, I think they are very sensitive to any indication that the outside world is trying to hold China back. So we're looking at their strength, and I think they're looking at their weakness.
And yet they're looking forward and looking forward to more strength. You're right that there's a pretty clear sense of the next 20 years and what China needs to do, what it intends to do in that period. Lay some of that out for us.
Well, I think the Chinese have a very clear understanding of what their problem is, and they have a clear understanding of what strategy they've been pursuing and what strategy they're going to continue to. And their sense of their situation is that the biggest security and risk that China faces is internally. Internal disorder, and of course the current difficulties in China with not only the Tibetans but the Uyghurs and also peasant dissatisfaction, pushes all the fears of instability in China. And they believe they have to have social stability in order to have economic growth, development, have an environment that foreigners want to invest in, and so forth. So stability internally is their major concern. Then secondly, they look at the outside world and say, what kind of world do we need in order to provide a cocoon for this this internal stability? And their highest priority, it may surprise many of the listeners, is, I think, to have good relations with the United States and the West, the EU, Japan, and almost everybody. But they don't always engage in policies that produce that. But they're looking to the outside world to, first of all, not create additional military or security threats for China. They're looking for capital. They're looking for technology. They're looking for management skills. They're looking for the outside world to help them move to reclaim share of global GNP. And therefore, the Chinese look at their foreign policy as enabling them to continue their focus domestically. So what's going on now with the Tibetans and the Uyghurs Uyghurs and more generally rural dissatisfaction in China, threatens the fundamental strategy of continuing to maintain stability, keep economic growth growing, and keep a foreign policy that keeps the resources flowing into China and minimizes threat. So what's going on now is just really quite contrary to the game plan of the Chinese.
Do Chinese leaders believe that they can, on this sort of historic march, that they can reclaim what they may see as their share of the global pie long-term without conflict? Or are they looking to build strength to be ready for conflict?
Well, the subtitle of the book is Might, Money, and Minds, the three kinds of broad power, economic, military, coercive, and intellectual. And at the beginning in 1978, the military, the might end of the spectrum, was a clear fourth priority. I would say since the mid-1990s, particularly when there was a crisis in the Taiwan Straits and China had to back down in the face of two American carrier battle groups and so forth, and also as the Chinese saw us operating in Kosovo and the first Gulf War, they upped the priority of their military somewhat in their modernization priority list. And so I think it's fair to say since 1995-96, the role of the might has gone up in the priority list. And I would say now the strategy is a somewhat balanced portfolio of might, money, and intellectual development. China does not want to be, I believe, a new Soviet Union. I mean, the Soviet Union was muscle-bound. It had a big military, but it had a weak and crumbling underlying economic system. The Chinese understand if they don't put goods on the shelves, they lose legitimacy with their people. So the economic priority, I think, is the clear number one priority. But the military's come up. But I think also central to the Chinese strategy is the intellectual dimension. They've quadrupled higher education since 1991.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China in the spotlight, a harsh spotlight right now, and the shape and state of Chinese influence in the world. My guest is David M. Lampton, author of the new book, The Three Faces of Chinese Power, Might, Money, and Minds. He's former president of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations and has thought a lot about Chinese power. Lots of Americans thinking about it this week as the Olympic torch makes its way to and through San Francisco. Even before that got started, we had climbers up on the Golden Gate Bridge unfurling Free Tibet banners. Here's one of them, interviewed by Foreign, Laurel Sutherland, saying that the problems that he caused for rush hour drivers in San Francisco were small compared to the situation of Tibetans.
This is an inconvenience, and it's unfortunate, but I think compared to the torture and the oppression that the Tibetan people have been living under for many decades, this is awfully minor compared to that.
Chinese leadership in Beijing not happy to see protests all over the front of the Olympics that they've invested so much in. Mike Lampton, I wonder if do you see the protests that we're all witnessing right now? We saw them in Europe, in San Francisco. Do you see this as... You mentioned China's soft power. Is it cutting into China's soft power? Is there some kind of contradiction in China's face to the world that makes it somehow inevitable? That is, it steps up into more evidently great power status. It's going to take more hits on exactly this kind.
Well, in the sense of China's increasing power producing enemies, I think as China acquires more capability to influence in the world, and as communications and travel increase, people become more aware of what's going on in China. But I think China's discovering what the United States discovered and what big powers before have discovered, and that is as they have the economic capacity to intervene or affect others' economies. China's had anti-China riots in the Solomon Islands, in Zambia, because of insensitive economic arrangements and lumbering techniques and environmental impacts. I think, as China gains power and aspires to be respected and a stakeholder in the international system, it's going to find itself hostage to the opinions and actions of others. And China's going to discover what every other great power has discovered, and that is there's no way to impact in the world without offending and alienating a lot of people.
So it's not easy, but is it inevitable? Do you see now enough momentum accumulated here that one way or another, China will be a larger and larger factor, a larger and larger power, even superpower? Is that now baked in the cake?
Well, I would say to the 95% certainty level that I think we have to, as a strategic proposition, count on China having a bumpy road but continuing to make rather astounding progress. And therefore, I think our children are going to face a more comprehensively powerful China, not only militarily but more importantly, perhaps economically and intellectually. And part of what we have to be thinking about and leaving to our children and grandchildren is a intellectual and economic and environmental infrastructure in our own country and in the world that allows us to become increasingly competitive as China does. Now, there are lots of uncertainties in the future of China, and the book has a whole chapter on what could go wrong. There are enormous numbers of things that could go wrong. But strategically, I wouldn't be betting against the Chinese people.
I want to look at each of those. First, on the economic, people around the world may think they have a pretty good sense of China's economic power. The products are everywhere, the balance of payments and the kind of bank accounts that the Chinese have built up look very, very imposing. And yet, I read you saying we're really just beginning to feel the kind of knock-on effects of what all that economic clout may mean going forward.
Right. One of the difficulties I had in writing the economic section of the book was that reality was changing so rapidly. I noted that in the book, and it was revised about on this point about 3 months before earlier, that China had just crossed the $1 trillion mark in holdings of foreign exchange. It's now at $1.53+ trillion. So it's just accumulating with unbelievable speed. This means that China is moving very rapidly to figure out how to invest productively these assets all over the world. In the book, I think I said that China had about $600 and some billion in U.S. Debt. Yeah, that number is now up to $934 billion of U.S. debt, not only Treasury notes, but mortgage, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, and all of this. But they also have corporate debt, state debt, local debt, and so forth. So just one manifestation is China. Poor China, in per capita terms, has become an enormous lender to the United States.
And with all that cash and lending, a lot of appetite as well, resource appetite that you've written. Is going to throw a shadow all over the place.
Well, yes. If you just look at the price of grains, they've doubled, depending on the commodity we're talking about, but roughly doubled in the last year. I was in Australia where I was interviewing for the book, and the Australians just see this as a resource bonanza. And indeed, one of the effects of this, of China becoming such a big buyer, and I think that's where Americans that we pay attention to China as a seller, all these exports, but where China's really getting political leverage in political systems and with our allies all over the world is it's a huge buyer. It is the most rapidly growing market for the United States and has been for a number of years, but it's the number one export market for Korea, the number one export market for Japan, for Taiwan. All our friends now have China as the number one or very high-ranking export market. And, the people who buy your exports, and that's now the Chinese, increasingly have a certain amount of political leverage. So you can see as these demonstrations are unfolding, and first in London, Paris, and and San Francisco today, you're seeing in general the governments much more restrained than some of the people in the streets because they recognize they have a long-term economic interest. Countries are competing for exports, and China's an enormous buyer as well as seller. And I think we don't realize the political leverage this gives the Chinese.
Buying power is real power, too. We've got a lot of people with questions for you. David M. Lampton is with us. His new book is The Three Faces of Chinese Power: Might, Money, and Minds. Mark is calling right now from Falmouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm blown away by what China is saying publicly right now about Tibet. Last night I was on the China Today website where there's a story with the headline, Dalai's brag about peace is nothing but lie. And in the story, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman calls the Dalai Lama as a representative of the old Tibet serf system, which he calls the darkest slavery system in human history. You know, for anyone in the world with even a cursory knowledge about the Dalai Lama in Tibet, they'll be very put off by these kind of schoolyard taunts and put-downs. And my question for Professor Lampton is, you know, how does the Chinese government think it can sustain its flagrant repression of Tibet while at the same time trying to be accepted and respected by the global community as a major power?
Mike?
Well, that's a good question, and I should start out by saying I've been to Tibet in 1981 when it was just beginning to open up once again after a long period of closure, and then again in 1991, but I haven't been recently. I've had the honor of meeting His Holiness the Dalai Lama on two occasions.
His Holiness, who the Chinese recently described, called a jackal wrapped in a habit, a monster with a human face and animal's heart. That's pretty hot stuff, as our caller says.
Right. It's pretty much out of Chinese school textbooks, actually.
Wow.
And one of the problems China's going to have in becoming more responsible and conciliatory is that it's created a view of Tibet and other issues, Taiwan and so forth, in its indoctrination and education of its children, that now, in some sense, the elite gets trapped by its own prior rhetoric. And one of the ironies, of course, is while the rest of the world, and I would include myself in that, are calling for dialogue with the Dalai Lama, many Chinese people, if you look at the internet in China, are actually accusing the government of not being sufficiently tough. So the Chinese government has created, I would say, a narrow understanding of what Tibet and the Dalai Lama ever were, and now they're hung up with expectations from not all but many of their people to take a tougher line. And so I think, you know, what the Chinese have to begin to do is start at the ground level in their educational system, and they have to create more of a fair understanding of controversial issues at the beginning, so they're going to have a reasonable population that they then can respond to when they're faced with difficulty. So this is going to be a long effort, and I don't, as much as I would like the Chinese to engage in dialogue with the Dalai Lama, quite frankly, I've been telling them for a very long period of time that the Dalai Lama is the moderate in his movement. He's the one who's willing to talk and be conciliatory. If the Dalai Lama were to pass away, we don't know exactly who would be the successor, so to speak, and that will be a big fight. But the best guess would be China will not find anyone more conciliatory to be dealing with than the Dalai Lama. So not only do they have this long-term problem, but I think they're making a short-term, and it'll turn out to be with long-term impact, not dealing with the Dalai Lama. But
you're saying the Chinese
are
sort of, I mean, we see them responding with what can feel like rage, even relatively high officials, in a tone that's unfamiliar to many folks in other countries in the United States. You're saying that is in part to appease the kind of Chinese we heard in tape earlier saying, hey, our government should be tough and it's right to and has to show its tough stuff?
Exactly. The Chinese have the Chinese government has really only two bases of legitimacy. One is that they produced economic goods and welfare for their people. And the other is that they have held China together as a nation and a civilization and in fact, brought back Hong Kong and Macau. They're working on Taiwan, but nationalism, broadly speaking. And so Chinese, I think, are very concerned when they see anything that looks like separatism, what the Chinese would call splitism, and so forth. So that the other aspect of the Chinese thinking here, and I'm not defending it, I'm simply trying to explain it, is that the Chinese have in order to control and extract resources and put military into Tibet over really since 1950, particularly since 1959, have put in a lot of roads and infrastructure. The average Chinese person thinks they've dumped a lot of money into Tibet. They, as surprising as it would sound to your caller and many other people, the average Chinese person thinks they've done a lot. And so what they put this in more in a framework of almost ingratitude. And then, of course, the regime made it on March 14th. You had those violent incidents of violence in which at least apparently some Tibetan civilians attacked Chinese business people. And, of course, this is what's shown in China. So the Chinese process this information. Tibetans, for whom we've done a lot, are attacking Han Chinese people. This is wrong. The government needs to be tougher.
Meanwhile, Tibetans saying you've overrun our turf here and, continue to send in more people, driving out our culture, driving out the Dalai Lama.
Exactly, and you're using overheated rhetoric to describe a person that's almost universally admired the world over. So this is about as bad a situation and bad a reaction as you could have hypothesized.
Let's take a call from Waynesboro, Pennsylvania. Pat, you're on the air.
I was struck by Professor Lampton's comments right at the top of the hour about how we have to balance the difference between the Chinese people and the Chinese government or regime. And I know how outraged I would be if we were having an upcoming Olympics Games in the United States, and the Chinese and the people in Europe protested. We had worldwide protests because of our invasion and continued presence in Iraq, even though 70% almost of the American people oppose.
But you'd be used to it, wouldn't you? I mean, America's had seen anti-America demonstrations for many decades now.
Right. But we have something in this country that the Chinese don't have, and that's elections. We can change our government's policy by people intervention. The Chinese don't have that luxury, I'm afraid. And the Chinese have always, we've always been told as we're growing up that a Chinese thing about saving face. We don't want to push them so far that they will be backed into a corner and feel that they have to save face.
Yeah, no kidding. That is really on the line right now. Pat, thanks for that. David Mike Lampton, can you see a way out of this right now for the Chinese to get through these next months, hold these hugely important and expensive Olympics, and save face at the same time, or are we headed for a train wreck here?
Well, there are many things that could go wrong. We're just seeing the first category of things that could go wrong. But just before I get into that list of things that could go wrong, because it's quite imposing, I do want to say, we've got to find a way to avoid humiliating the Chinese people, which will, I think, drive them into the arms of their government, and at the same time keep up the pressure, so to speak, on the regime to make positive change and engage in dialogue and so forth. So that seems to me our problem. President Bush right now, I think, is being wise to say he's going to go to the games, but, his schedule is fluid. Mm. So it keeps out there various contingencies depending on what happens. But I think that on balance, 10 years from now, we would be very sorry if we emotionally signed on to a kind of anything that looked like a boycott. But I think we have to recognize this is only the first kind of category of things that could go wrong. Once the Olympics gets going, of course, we don't know what China's own disaffected people will do or how the regime will react. And we can't count on the regime having a moderate reaction, and global television will be there if it isn't. Certainly, we're going to have a whole possibility of participants in the Olympics themselves demonstrating in various ways their grievances or dissatisfactions or objections. We also have the problem that obviously they're going to be every country of the world practically is going to have a team there. And many countries of the world, take Spain and the Basque separatists, for example. This is going to be a stage on which the whole world will act out its grievances against not only China but other teams. There could be an environmental you know, disaster pollution and affecting race outcomes and so forth. And then there'll be the people attending the Olympics that they'll have their own attitude. So I think this is just the beginning of a series of delicate and risky situations for the Chinese.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China in the spotlight, a very harsh spotlight right now, and the shape and direction of Chinese influence in the world. My guest is David Michael Lampton. He's author of The Three Faces of Chinese Power, Might, Money, and Minds. He's also Dean of Chinese Studies at the Nixon Center and Dean of Faculty at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, former president of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations. Mike Lampton, I wish you'd speak to the minds piece of the trio of power pieces that you're writing about here. We touched the economy a little bit. The military is still sitting out there, but on the minds front, are you just talking about, you know, thousands and thousands of Chinese engineers, or are you saying China's presenting a new sort of intellectual model, a new ideas model for the world? Is it there? Is it taking?
Well, I think what I have in mind with the idea of minds is, first of all, if you look and interact with Chinese leaders, and I don't mean to be construed as saying Chinese leaders always make the correct or even moral, in my view, decision. But when you start with leaders of China, whether they're corporate leaders or they're political leaders or they're county leaders or municipal leaders, one is very impressed with the general quality of Chinese leadership. China has a very self-conscious leadership training system.
So impressed I would say, what dimensions? Right.
Well, their understanding increasingly of economics, their understanding of technical issues, their commitment to building the infrastructure for China's long-term development, roads and communications, their ability to increasingly not only speak to other governments, but they're trying to build the infrastructure to more effectively speak to other societies. Their space programs in part a effort to build a global communications capability. I met once with China's president, Jiang Zemin, and he says, you Americans say all people are equal. Well, that's not true, because you have the capacity to reach with your popular culture, your news, your interpretation of events, the whole world. You shape world opinion. Well, we're going to do that, too. Now, in this week and all of these events,
they don't look so brilliant right now.
It doesn't look so good. But China's putting in place that. I think China's weakest point, and I'm quite clear about this in the book, in this area, is what I would call what President Reagan used to call the shining city in the hill. I think that, this idea of a respected political model that the U.S. was, a well-governed civic society. China doesn't have that now. There's respect in the world for China's growth, in many parts of the world that are in turmoil. They also envy China's stability, even at the cost of what we would call authoritarianism. But China doesn't have that respected civic culture, a liberal political environment. And this is where I think the economics and the intellectual have to meet for China. And that is, the economic growth and development of China is creating a middle class in China. Now, there are various debates about how big it is, but let's say the middle class is, just for illustration, 300 million people. That's bigger than the United States, or about the same size as the population of the U.S., but they still have a billion relatively poor people that aren't in the middle class. But this 300 million people is beginning to demand a more predictable law, a more civic society, more political participation, less abuse of individual rights, and so forth. So China's got the Bunsen burner on here, cranking up the number of middle class people they're creating.
But that's been growing for a while, and we don't see democracy there yet. We don't see human rights in a way that most of the world would recognize them honored there yet. We don't see the democracy breaking out, certainly. I mean, if Jiang Zemin doesn't like the American ideas impact on the world, or Hollywood's anyway, but what's China's alternative? Is it going to be top-down power, markets, but not human rights? I mean, is that the model?
Well, first of all, I don't think China's leaders have a clear image of how to get to the next stage, and it's my understanding that, frankly, the people that are running China now hope to, you know, get through their terms without fundamental political change. So I don't expect this current political leadership.
And their terms
to
last a long time, as we've
right.
seen.
Well, it's going to go till 2012, and now they're beginning to shape the next generation. Mm. We'll have to see. Remember, we didn't expect Gorbachev to come out of the Soviet system, and he and Yeltsin emerged rather unpredictably and rather rapidly. And I think this is going to be a process. But also, we have to remember, we're talking about a government that's governing 22% of the world's people. This is a big, big job. And even Taiwan, which at the time had, you know, 18 million people. It took Taiwan about 50 years between when the Kuomintang took over Taiwan and when they had their first presidential election. So even a small authoritarian society took 50 years. China's really been on this road since 1978. So the world isn't going to be infinitely patient, that's for sure, and the Chinese people aren't going to be infinitely patient. But we have to also keep in mind the scale of what's being attempted. I think also that implicitly, we shouldn't create the idea that somehow cataclysmic political change, sudden political change in China would be an unvarnished good in the sense that turmoil and disorder in China in the past have had very high human consequences. Even the relatively, we'll say, the peaceful fall of the Soviet Union led to a decade of rising infant mortality rates in China, in the former Soviet Union and so forth. So, the best scenario for everybody would be growing middle class, growing liberalization, and a pace that looks something like what happened in Taiwan. So the strategy, from my point of view, ought to be pushing the economic development, pushing intercourse of the world, keeping the demands up, but not pushing the system to the absolute breaking point.
Let's go to Peter calling from Boston. Hi, Peter, you're on the air.
My point is, picking up on this idea of Chinese authoritarianism, you know, it isn't just since 1978. They have a 5,000-year tradition of centralized, oppressive, authoritarian style of government. And I'm drawing a lot from Jared Diamond's book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, and comparing different cultural developments. And China has been centralized for millennia. And I think, Professor, you're being way too easy on China when you comment that every growing world power has to deal with world criticism and China has to get used to this. I think it matters, you know, criticism for what? And what China has done in Tibet is horrible. It's an oppressive colonial takeover of a peace-loving country. And I think we have to ask serious questions about whether we can accommodate ourselves to the Chinese traditions of... And I want to ask this in the sense of course, we have to get along with them, but I think we can't drop the criticism or soft-pedal it or say that it's just a consequence of power and not a consequence of what they're doing. Mm. What they're doing is horrific.
Peter, thanks for your call. Mike Lampton?
you're absolutely right. I wouldn't want to be understood to have meant that China's difficulties now in many places of the world are only a result of its increasing influence and therefore get used to it. That is part of my view. And I think even if China had much more benign internal policies, it would still face criticism for the use of its power in ways others don't approve, both internally and externally.
But there did seem to be an implicit expectation on your part that China might over time move toward a more liberalized society. And our caller Peter's saying maybe not. Maybe what China's agenda internally and globally will be just the opposite of that. Maybe it becomes maybe its minds push for something more hierarchical, more authoritarian globally.
Well, I do think your caller talked about 5,000 years of centralized authoritarian history. And that's part of what I meant about, you know, you have 1.3 3 billion people with their own history, their own political culture, and it's not in all respects been historically compatible with individual liberty and self-initiative and protection of civil rights. So that's part of what has to be overcome. You're absolutely right also that there is no assurance that as China's either its middle class grows or as it modernizes, it'll become more cosmopolitan and liberal. But I think we have some reasons for optimism. It's not a sure thing, but I think it's the best bet we have. And that optimism comes from the experience of South Korea and Taiwan, where they both were in the Cold War period authoritarian regimes and under pressure from the outside world and their own economic development, they've developed more liberal systems. So we have that going for us. We also have some serious social science research going on in China, and it's not definitive, but there's a professor at Harvard University, Ian Johnston, who's surveyed the attitudes of urban residents in China, and as they become more exposed to the world and enter what we'd arguably call the middle class, they seem to be becoming more liberal, both in terms of foreign policy and their inclinations for governance. If we don't, if we say, well, that may not be true. What is the implication? Then we adopt a set of more punitive policies that the Chinese will interpret to be directed at frustrating their modernization. And I think then we have to expect growing Chinese power to be used in ways that are increasingly not friendly. So there are no guarantees here. You don't get the option to keep rerunning history until you like the outcome.
So
I think history, both in the region, recent history, and then history of the development of democracies in Europe, suggests that the middle class plays a big role. Will that be definitive? And I just say one last thing. There is considerable evidence that right now the middle class actually fears the rest of the poor masses of China more than it fears the elite. So at the current moment, I think you could make the argument that the emerging middle class has sort of implicitly, to some extent, allied itself with the elite to maintain stability, because the elite and the middle class think they have an interest in protecting themselves from dissatisfied majority.
What a picture. And the very power that you're writing about here, the enormous power of China, an interesting question, whether that leads it over time to be more interested in liberalization or more resistant because it has the power to resist. Let's go to Teresa, and if I may, in Scituate, Massachusetts. Teresa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to discuss an incident, a traffic incident in China in 2005.
So okay, that's we're all ears.
There are a lot
I
of those.
I agree with him about the middle class. I assume anyone who was driving is middle class if they have a car.
Fair enough.
And we were in the largest rotary in Beijing, and some lady, gal ahead of us, got into a little fender bender. But it tied up all the commuter traffic for miles around. And we all had a very good view, being a very large rotary.
Right.
Well, the policeman arrived, and they were discussing the incident. And the next thing we all knew, she became heated. And goodness, she had her fingers almost up to his eyeballs.
She didn't seem too afraid of the policeman.
Well, I would have been in the back seat of the cruiser in Boston by now.
Right.
Well, anyhow, he remained so calm. He was highly trained to remain calm, and all those policemen are. And what? He calmly ignored her, the fingers in his eyeballs. He wrote a traffic ticket, handed it to her. By this time, all the Chinese drivers were honking their horns. You know, it was a potential incident.
Teresa, how far are you prepared to extrapolate from that little fender bender in Beijing, though? Do you expect that same kind of restraint from China on the global stage? Are you really willing to go that far?
No, I just think with its own people, after Tiananmen Square, they realize they have to be very careful because it's a tinderbox.
Well, sometimes, but the heads can get cracked pretty hard at other times from what we see. Teresa, thanks for sharing that incident with us. you can hear, Mike, Professor Lampton, Americans kind of going back and forth on trying to figure out what attitude to take here. It's not easy.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, one of the great qualities of Americans are their respect for diversity and intrinsic admiration of other cultures. And certainly China has one of the most embroidered and interesting cultures and history in the world. And I think there's a natural affinity of Americans for that. On the other hand, there are some dark sides from an American individualist rights-oriented view. And we're very much committed to that. And I think China presents a great, almost moral dilemma for Americans. And I think what we have to do is have enough respect for Chinese people and Chinese civilization to have some confidence that they will push in a productive direction. In the end, the power to change China is within China principally, not the outside. And I think we ought to have the perspective of how can we facilitate that within our limited capacity to the best of our ability.
You know, we're going to be jumping on a plane within not too many hours here and taking the show to Shanghai to broadcast for a week, next week, directly out of China. It's been a few years since I was in Shanghai. We've all seen that skyline go up. But it's not just fancy skylines in China these days. As you say, even if 300 million are middle class, that's a billion who are not.
That's right. One of my favorite economists in China, Huan Gang, talks about four Chinas. 10% of China is in the Shanghai China, so to speak, that level of development, sort of a middle European level of development. But 50% of the Chinese people are still in the condition of the world's poorest people. The Tibetans are among the poorest in China. So China has this problem, how to meet the expectations of, you know, economically middle-class people on a world standard at the same time they're trying to bring up 600 to 700 million people that are in abject poverty. And I take congressmen to China all the time, and they usually come back with two opinions. One is, this is more complicated than I thought. And the other is, thank goodness I don't have to deal with this set of problems.
Well, whatever it is, it's enormous, and we'll be in the middle of it next week. David Mike Lampton's new book is The Three Faces of Chinese Power, Might, Money, and Minds. Professor Lampton, thank you so much for being with us today.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Listeners, the next time you hear from me, it will be from Shanghai on Monday. Our new China website is up already. It's at onpointradio.org/China. Check it out. We're on our way. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talk to you from Shanghai.